This is BBC Radio 6 Music.
Right now, it's Matt Everett's The First Time with Tony Visconti.
Hello, I'm Matt Everett, and welcome to The First Time here on BBC Six Music. This is the series where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and look at the seminal first musical moments that shaped their lives and their careers. This week's guest is a producer who can lay claim to having helped create some of the most important rock records ever. His career started in the mid-60s but runs through to the present day and includes the Manic Street Preachers and Thin Lizzy, Sparks, Morrissey, the Stranglers, Rick Wakeman, the Boomtown Rats, and most recently, The Good, the Bad and the Queen. But he also had a deep personal and professional relationship with Mark Bolan, honing the sound that made Mark and T-Rex colossal stars, and most famously, David Bowie. Someone he worked with repeatedly, from his 1969 debut album through the iconic Berlin trilogy of records, and returning to work with him on his last albums, 2013's The Next Day, and his final masterpiece, Black Star. My guest on The First Time this week is Tony Visconti. Here Tony talks about the music that surrounded him as a child, his earliest gigs, seeing Little Richard in the flesh, and his career as a session musician in his home city of New York, and also the very earliest recordings that he worked on. We also discuss his first Bolan albums and, of course, his work with David Bowie, starting off with their very first meeting, going on to the Berlin trilogy of albums, Low, Heroes and Lodger. And Tony also talks about those final sessions that took place while Bowie was suffering from cancer at the end of his career. But he also talks about his methodology in the studio, how he works with artists, developing ideas, how he deals with tension and gets the best performances and songs on tape. But I started by asking Tony, as I do with all my guests, when was the first time he was aware of music?
My first awareness of music was my mother singing to me. She was a first-generation Italian-American, and she sang these beautiful songs from her mother's maiden land, Italy, specifically Naples. And my mother had a beautiful kind of mezzo-soprano voice. So, and then my dad was in a barbershop quartet. Before I could even speak, I heard this sound of harmony.
What was the first kind of piece of music you can remember by name that you identified as being something?
Well, I grew up when Bing Crosby was still making pop records, and I probably heard White Christmas. And there was a comedian musician called Spike Jonze that my father adored. He would take a pop song of the day and completely lampoon it. He would do cocktails for two and clink cocktail glasses together and sneeze and cough and all sorts of things. And the music was really dead clever. He would play melodies on pots and pans.
Now little Bo Peep wants to find her Jeep and find her soldier chappy. If he comes chug chuggy in his old bits buggy, Bo Peep will be happy.
I kind of got the humor even at a very young age, maybe about 3 or 4. I thought they were hilarious records.
What about the first instrument that you played?
My first instrument was ukulele. And I remember I was 5 years old, and that was my Christmas present for my parents.
That's five, that's young.
Yeah, it was. And I think there was a guitar in the corner of the flat that I grew up in, and I kept playing it like it was a bass fiddle. I mean, I would just hold it upright and pluck the strings. And so the ukulele made sense, and it was a great ukulele. It was made of plastic. So that was a good start. I think my earliest recollection of seeing live music was actually a Broadway musical.
Okay.
And my parents took me to see Annie Get Your Gun.
That's a good musical.
It's a great, you can't get a man with a gun and all that stuff. And my father had the album, which was on 78 records. So an album really was an album of records in those days. And he'd pull out the 78, one song per side. And I knew the whole score. I knew it by heart. So I embarrassed them by singing in the theater. I was only about maybe seven years old, 6 or 7. And I sung on top of my lungs. And I didn't, people thought it was amusing. I didn't get scolded or anything.
What about that moment when you, a bit older, you start to discover music that's kind of yours, that belongs to you?
At 10 years old, we had a DJ called Alan Freed. And I think I must have caught his second or third show on the radio. I mean, he was somewhere out in the Midwest locally, and then he got franchised and he was in New York suddenly. And Alan Freed used to do these rock and roll reviews, which would have on any given bill as many as a dozen different artists, and they would do two songs each. So the show was, 70 minutes long.
Just two songs.
Out would run Buddy Holly, and they would go into, That'll Be the Day and Not Fade Away, and that was it. And then he ran off, and then maybe an R&B act would come on next, like the Flamingos or Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. All these people were on one single bill. And what I would do is get up really, really early and make the first show, which I think was probably 10 a.m. And then we'd all hide in the men's room and stay until they cleaned the theater for the second show. So I would often get in two shows, the second show for free. And I would take the subway from where I lived, the underground from where it was a good maybe 35, 40 minutes from where I lived on the other side of Brooklyn, New York.
Lucy!
I would go by the backstage door and meet people like, I saw Little Richard sit on the back of his lavender Cadillac convertible, and he and a mate was sitting on the back seat with the top down, and with his toe, he had lavender winkle pickers, and with his toe, he flicked a switch on the dashboard and an electric antenna went up, and then he flicked it and it went down. But I would meet often the band members who were in the pit band, and they would play behind, say, Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers. They needed a little R&B band, and I'd say hello to them, get their autographs. So that was, that was quite a young age to be going out with my friends and without my parents and seeing a live concert. I was really young.
You're brought up around music, around harmony. You've got an instrument from a young age, and you're finding the satisfaction of learning how to play, and you're watching this live music. This is set for you, isn't it, really? There's nowhere else to go. It's going to be music in your life. You're going to form a little band, aren't you?
I formed a band. You're absolutely right.
What are they called? Go on, because it's always a bad name, or at least a pretty...
It's a terrible name. Oh, my gosh. Mike D was the sax player. Something like... It wasn't Mike D and the Donuts, but it was... Something as horrible as that,
So when does this turn into a professional concern? When do you start doing like a little bit of session and start actually maybe getting a bit of money from the gigs here? When does that change?
Well, by the time I was 14, you know, New York is a fantastic place to grow up and for opportunities like this, because there's a kind of a tin pan alley there that existed in those days on a place called 48th Street in Manhattan, which was just had door-to-door guitar shops and drum shops and all that. And above the shops were little recording studios where people would make demos. I wasn't good enough for the big time, but for $12, I would go in and play three songs, and some person would sing, and they'd make the demo mainly for publishing purposes. And that was the way I really started off being a session man.
When did the fascination start with what was happening on the other side of the glass in the studio then? You were like, well, there's some people, there's some knobs, and there's some more cables, and they're capturing this.
Well, that's interesting, because you were never allowed on the other side of the glass in those days. They would, you know, it was like the Wizard of Oz, you know. You weren't allowed to see how they did this stuff.
Which, of course, for any kid makes it more appealing.
Of course, yeah. And, you know, I slowly realized that producers had that job for a reason. They could fine-tune, you know. So I wanted that job, basically. I wanted to be on the other side of the glass. I heard records that had things like slapback echo and reverb. And I really couldn't get a job in a studio, but I started out making home studios. My dad had a tape recorder because he was an accordion player, and he always wanted to practice and play. I commandeered that recorder. I turned it into a little recording studio, and I found I could get good echo in our long hallway. So if I sang about 10 feet away from the microphone, I had all this reverb, you know, and it was good. I have some records I made from those days.
Really?
Yeah. It was great, a great experience. I learned from, you know, if I couldn't get the job, I invented the studio.
What was your first production job over here?
I helped Denny Cordell in New York with a Georgie Fame production, which led me to come to England to do more work for Denny. He said, I've got a session with Manfred Mann, and I'm double booked. I have to be at Olympic Studios with my band Procol Harum. But I promised I'd work with Manfred Mann. He goes, so I'm going to take you there, and I'll stay for about 2 hours, and I'm going to put you in charge.
Second day in. Nice.
Second day in. I couldn't even speak British yet. I had no idea what they were saying. You know.
What was the song?
It was a Randy Newman song, and it was called So Long, Dad. And it was released. Denny finished it. He came back the next day and finished it.
My butt, it's great to be back. Again, the streets are not much cleaner. The quaint old hometown scenery is quaint no more. Just older than before. Go up the stairs and down the hallway to my daddy's door.
BBC Radio 6
Music. You want to hear about my third day in England?
Of course.
That was the most exciting. So, you know, I was a Beatles fan. I was a Rolling Stones fan. And we went to the Olympic Studios in Barnes. And we went into Studio 2 to work on the Procol Harum album that they were cutting at the time. Denny was producing them.
We skip the life and dangle. Turns cartwheels across the floor.
Both Denny and I had to go to the loo or something. We both went out into the corridor and we bumped right into Brian Jones. And because the Stones were recording 10 feet away in the next studio. Now, I'm a kid from Brooklyn, and here's my third day in London, and here I am face to face with Brian Jones. So he said to Denny that he had heard A Whiter Shade of Pale on the radio.
When we call out for a dream, the way to broad trail.
And he said in a very posh voice, I sent my chauffeur out to buy a copy, you know. And he had a kind of a purple Edwardian jacket with ruffles.
Brilliant.
And some kind of a ruby medallion. And he had makeup on and mascara.
That's amazing. There is, around that time, the eclecticism of the stuff that you worked on, it seemed to almost set the tone for the rest of your career. You were working with Badfinger before they were Badfinger. And you worked with Marsha Hunt, and completely different styles of stuff, that's going to make you good. Like being a session guy, knowing that you've got different characters, different styles, different sounds every session, that's going to sharpen you pretty quickly, isn't it?
Of course, and that was the reason why I wanted to get to London, because I heard the most influential album of my life when I was still living in New York, and that was Revolver by the Beatles. That album is alchemy. There's no other way to describe it. It is a magical album, and there were sounds on there which I couldn't possibly identify. The Beatles were making new sounds of instruments that did not exist anymore. They even, I think, there was a sitar on that album for the first time. And George Harrison was getting a droney sound out of his guitar, which sounded like an industrial drill. And that's exactly why I came to London. I could tell that the British musicians, the real creative ones, were breaking all the rules. But I did not realize that my success in finding the next was going to be a solo artist. And that's where I met David Bowie and T-Rex, and Mark Bolan from T-Rex, all in the same month.
You're so sweet. You're so fast.
Especially the sort of Electric Warrior era, it's just there's a confidence in the performance and the sound and the songwriting. There's a completeness to those recordings that far outstrip anything that was happening at the time. It's no wonder he was such a big star at the time, because they are supremely perfect moments of pop captured in all respects.
I know. It's amazing how T-Rex got so big and so good, because it started out as Tyrannosaurus Rex, and Mark was kind of struggling with the acoustic guitar and the bongo drums, because the Tyrannosaurus Rex was initially modeled after the Incredible String Band, and he got the magical number 12 quid, a 12 quid acoustic guitar, which had a broken peg on the G string, so he carried a pair of pliers with him to tune up the G string of this guitar. And that guitar is what I heard him play. And that's the guitar we used on the first album. And it sounds absolutely great when you listen to that. He and David used to come to my flat in Earl's Court, Kensington, actually. And I had a Stratocaster and a P bass, electric bass, and an acoustic guitar. And they would take one guitar or the other. I would take the bass, and we would jam. We would jam all night long. I didn't have enough tape, and I know you'll kill me, but I didn't tape one single jam.
Oh, God.
But by the time we got to Unicorn, we knew how to make singles, only we didn't have the tones yet. But the next album, which was, I believe, T-Rex, that's when we got it right. Absolutely right. And the first magical single we made was Ride a White Swan.
Ride it all out like a bird in the sky. Was ride it all out like you were a bird. Fly it all out like an eagle in a sunbeam. Ride it all out like you were a bird.
And there are precursors of that on the album T-Rex. And Ride a White Swan was recorded during those sessions, but not included, because Mark said, and this was great about him, I don't want the kids to have to buy the song twice. He goes, well, I don't want to put the single on the album.
And your first impressions of David?
In the beginning, David didn't know what he wanted to do. He was kind of scattered. He was trying things out. Because he had this big voice, my publisher boss, David Platz, said, I want you to listen to this guy. He said, you seem to be an expert with weird artists. And he was referring to T-Rex and Mark Bolan, whom he considered weird. And he said, maybe you'll know what to do with them. So I heard three tracks from the, I think it was called The World of David Bowie, that album.
There's a little churchyard just along the way. Used to be Lambeth's finest array of tombstones, epitaphs, wreaths, flowers, all that jazz, till the war came along and someone dropped a bomb on the lot. And in this little yard there's a little old man with a little shovel in his little bitty hand. He seems to spend all his days puffing fags and digging graves. He hates the Reverend Vicar and he lives all alone in his home.
And I heard Mr. Gravedigger and When I Live My Dream, I think it was. And I said, he's fabulous. His voice is really great, but he's all over the place. I wouldn't even know which style to pursue, but you just played me three songs in three different styles. So he said, okay, that's fair observation. That's what we see. Would you like to meet him? I said, of course I would, yeah. He goes, he's in the next room. So it was kind of a setup, and we started speaking within seconds. We excluded David Platts. You know, we was talking about the Fugs, San Francisco underground band, Velvet Underground, Frank Zappa, Roman Polanski. You know, within 10 minutes, we knew that we were kindred souls, you know, kindred spirits. We loved the same things, and they were far out things, which was very dangerous, because what he needed was reeling in, if anything, I was going to get him to go out further, you know. And anyway, we really liked each other, and I think we were told to leave the building because we stayed till office hours ended, and we walked down Oxford Street, and I lived in somewhere along the way, and somehow we ended up on the King's Road. And we were still chatting away. And we passed a cinema that played foreign films. And lo and behold, they had the latest Roman Polanski film there. We were just talking about Roman Polanski. It was something like 7 in the evening. And we just went in and saw A Knife in the Water together. We had a very, very long initial conversation, which lasted from early afternoon till 10 p.m. in the evening. And that was how we started off. It wasn't all that musical. It was an exchange of ideas, you know. And we became really, really good friends. I never really got that close with Mark Bolan. There was a friendship there too, but with David and I just were like, you know, we were like long-lost brothers. But when we finally got in the studio, I did reel him in and we did a track called Let Me Sleep Beside You for D-Ram, I do believe it was.
Brush the dust of youth from off your shoulder, because the years of fretting days is right behind you now. Don't return to fields of green where rainbow secrets were told. Place your ragged doll with all the toys and paints and beads. I will show you game where the wind never wins. Let your hair hang down where the dress your mother wore. Let me sleep beside you.
Good song, that.
Oh, it's great. And he has aired it from time to time. What else did we do? Karma Man, which was his song about Tibetan Buddhism. I really love those tracks. We had amazing musicians on there. Like, I think John Paul Jones played organ, Hammond organ, or bass, I don't know. But it must have taken a year or two before we actually made a record that sold. But in that period, we were doing things like the Arts Lab, which he did, which started in a pub in Beckenham. And he had light shows. It was great.
The Man Who Sold the World is an album that you've always said it's a record that's really close to you. I mean, all of them are. But there's something about that record that you find especially appealing. Because it is. Once again, it's a way out record. It sounds way out. The mix is very strident. A lot of separation, but a lot of power.
Yeah.
You've played it live. It's one of the records that you sometimes take out as well. In terms of getting that sound up on the board, it doesn't sound like a lot of stuff that was going on at the time. Can you remember thinking, okay, we're going out on a bit of a limb here?
We had a phenomenal guitarist with us, Mick Ronson. And between the four of us, we had Woody Woodmansey on drums. We decided we're going to be a power rock trio with a lead singer because we wanted to go out live, and David really never had a band. We did have some far-out sounds with songs like Savior Machine, which we had a synthesizer. We had the first big Moog synthesizer in this country. It was like four fridges side by side with knobs on it. And we got a virtuoso keyboard player, a guy called Ralph Mace, whom we met through David's label. He was on Phonogram then. And Ralph Mace was the head of the classical music department, but he took a liking to us. And he said he could play piano. He was a concert pianist. And so I told David, I said, we were influenced by the Wendy Carlos album of Switched on Moog, you know, Switched on Moog synthesizer. And that was featured in Clockwork Orange film, you know, so we wanted that sound. But who the hell could play it? We couldn't play it. And the thing I'm so fond about The Man Who Sold the World is that probably 70% of David's future writing style is on that album. That was the beginning of David Bowie. It was the beginning of The Spiders from Mars, which was just about a year later. You know, even when we were making The Next Day and Black Star, we would go back to things we did on The Man Who Sold the World and try to update them because they were just cool things. You know, why should we do something? You know, we've already done this. Let's air it again. You know, now it's time to air this sound again, something like that.
What did you and David think of the Nirvana cover of The Man Who Sold the World?
We laughed. Both of us had to tell people that Nirvana didn't write the song.
Oh no, not me. We never lost control. The face to face of the man who sold the world.
You know, that's what I mean. So we made this album in the early 70s, and it wasn't a big hit. It did sell over a million eventually, but it wasn't a big hit then. So we have to take things out from there and bring it into the future and say, okay, you didn't listen to us the first time. Here it comes the second or third time, you know.
I was trying to think a way of talking about Low and Heroes in a way that hasn't been done before, because it's very difficult, because there's very few albums that have been disseminated and studied and loved so much. But there was one quote that you said that was really interesting, was that you approached all the recordings like demos.
Yes.
They're meticulously planned out. There's so many different levels and textures in there. You imagine it was all, okay, before we go in, we know exactly what it's going to be. But saying they were demos is a really interesting way of approaching them.
Absolutely nothing was planned. There was no plan whatsoever. He and I had a phone call with Brian Eno, and he said to me, with Brian on the extension, he goes, I have an idea for an ambient album, because originally the album, if we did have an idea, was going to be more like Brian's music, which was music for airports, synth, you know, and dreamy and floaty music. He goes, but it might be a total disaster. He goes, it's going to be demos. We're just going to record some stuff. And I'm asking you, basically, are you prepared to waste a month of your life? And I said, excuse me. I said, to be in the studio with you and Brian Eno for 1 month, it would not be wasting any month of my life. That would be an incredible month. And I'm sure the three of us can come up with something great. And, you know, they said, well, what will you bring to the table? And I had this this first digital device in the UK called a Harmonizer. And I can't say the inappropriate word on the air, but they said, what does it do? And I said, it kind of, the word begins with an F. It Fs with the fabric of time, which they whooped. They literally whooped. They were on two separate extensions. And they said, that's great. Bring it. Let's do it. So about a week or two later, I found myself in the studio with them. And by that time, it evolved to, like, we're going to have a band there just in case. You know, we might write some pop songs. I found myself in the studio with Dennis Davis and Carlos Alomar, George Murray, Ray Young from the older days. You know, he was in Hamburg when the Beatles were in Hamburg. Ray Young, the keyboard player.
Wow.
So there we are, but already the pop songs were crazy, like Sound and Vision. We had this groove, and there were no lyrics yet, and we didn't know what it was, where a verse was, or anything. This was more or less the way half of The Man Who Sold the World was done, too, and it was frustrating at that time, because I was a novice record producer, and I was on a tight budget, and you know, David wouldn't write the lyric until the day it had to be mixed. And so, you know, it drove me nuts. But here we are in low now. Now that's de rigueur. Now we have to, you know, just make music and figure out what it is later. So every track was more or less conceived that way. No tracks had lyrics. And in fact, the opening and closing of side A were instrumentals, but they weren't intentionally instrumentals. They could have very well had lyrics written. But after about a week, it took shape. That we knew where we were going with it.
Sometimes it gets so lonely. Sometimes you get nowhere.
In the meantime, the first week, I put the Harmonizer to work with playing it, using it on different instruments, but mainly the snare drum, where it dropped in pitch suddenly. Even Brian and David thought that was too far out. They said, I don't know about this. So we parked it on track 24. I just kept recording the return from the Harmonizer on track 24. And every time people were in the other room and I was just alone, I would just lift it up and say, I'm going to make this work. I've never heard anything like this in my life, you know. I had already found this sound back in London. But on the ambient side, I started using it on a lot of Brian synth patches and sort of electric guitars. There's a beginning of, I don't know which, I guess sometimes I get these confused with the Heroes, which we did the same thing. But trust me, I was using it on other instruments and vocals and things like that. Then after 2 weeks, we did all those tracks in 1 week.
That's quick. That's so quick.
And Brian left after the second week. And David and I were left for the final 2 weeks. We spent a month in the chateau trying to overdub and finally doing, he would write lyrics. I mean, he couldn't write the lyrics with Brian present and the band present. So some afternoons, we'd just, you know, I'd go to the pool with my kids. I had my kids there, and there was a pool there. And I'd come back when he had a lyric written or an idea, and I would come with an idea. You know, it was like more, a little more casual. So that's how it was made. It was made in 1 month, not mixed yet. For that, we went to Berlin, and that is why it is the first song in the Berlin trilogy. So we went to Hansa Studios in Berlin and continued to make more sense of what we had recorded. Brought the Harmonizer with me. We used that for the mixing inside the city, inside of West Berlin. And I can't remember the name of the street, but it was where David recorded The Idiot. That's how Low is made. And I'll tell you, Heroes is not much different, but except that it was all done in Berlin.
amazing that, yeah, there's very few albums that have made themselves part of not just music culture, but the way people think about experimentation can be summed up in those records.
Yes.
A certain kind of, when an artist wants to go and try something different, they bugger off to Berlin. It's become like almost a shorthand for experimentation.
Yes.
That must make you enormously proud.
Very proud, and there was great opposition from the label. When we put Low out, you know, it just followed Young Americans, which was an enormous hit. There was three or four singles on that.
Bit of a left turn.
Yeah. And the label, which were these very same descendants of... No, they were actually the very same kind of New York types, the cigar-chewing. They said, I'm going to buy him a house in Philadelphia. You know, they wanted Young Americans too. They thought we were crazy. Why would we break up the formula? Like, there was Hall & Oates out there and there were other blue-eyed soul people, you know. And that is precisely why David Bowie wouldn't make Young Americans too. And if he has any plan, that was always his plan from album to album. Never repeat the former success. Never get pigeonholed, you know, just keep pushing the boundaries, which I've always respected him for. And he respected me that, you know, I'm making hit singles with T-Rex, and like, I guess he was alluding to the fact that if you come and make this album, you might waste a month of your hit-making life, you know, you might lose money in that month, you know. I didn't care, because how could you turn down an offer to work with David Bowie and Brian Eno? You know, that was just incredible. And we continued to do that. You know, we actually had this kind of success we wanted from that. It was on David's terms, you know, and we just finally keep doing it. We kept doing it until, you know, we didn't set out to make a trilogy, but by the time we did Larger, it was done. You know, we went our separate ways after that.
I went back to Lodger a couple of weeks ago. I hadn't listened to it for a long time. It's a really difficult but really good record, that. I don't think it gets the love it deserves sometimes, that album.
Well, it's not a good sounding album. I think the music's terrific, and it came time to mix it in New York. We were assigned to this backroom mixing suite. In fact, it was an overdub suite. And in those days, they didn't have instrument hire where you could phone up and ask for equipment delivered, you know, to supplement what you had and what you needed in a studio lacking a certain piece of equipment. And just everybody was recording in those days. There was, like, I don't know, Rolling Stones in that studio and all that. We just couldn't get a studio. And we had to finish off in that little place.
It sounds ridiculous that you guys couldn't get a studio.
Well, you know, David didn't have that kind of respect he has now or later in later years. You know, he was just another British artist in America. And, you know, he wasn't doing Ziggy anymore. For all intents and purposes, he was finished in some people's eyes. You know, he was not, they didn't get the chameleon thing yet, you know. he did music, you know, he did the Elephant Man. People probably thought he was, he wants to be an actor, you know, in that city. He's not making music. So we weren't treated very well. And we managed to get through it. We mixed it. We had Mick Jagger visit us during that. And he was criticizing the sound and stuff. And David, out and out, asked him to leave. He says, I think your tone is rather negative. And, you know.
I'm just trying to imagine what that conversation was like, how terse that might have been.
It was exactly like that. Suddenly, you know, David was dying to please Mick Jagger. And he was just taking, you know, like he was being so negative about it. So, and we found out he was doing it on purpose. This was a thing he was doing to people in those days. So he says, okay, I can see I'm not wanted here. I'm going to go down the road and sabotage Joni Mitchell's album. He used the word sabotage.
Look back in anger, driven by the night, till you come. Waiting so long, I've been waiting so late. Look back in anger, see it in my eyes, till you come.
BBC Radio 6
Music.
For you as a producer as well, and I mean this as a compliment, you don't have a sound. If you listen to a Rick Rubin record, as brilliant as many of them are, you can tell it's a Rick Rubin record. You know, Nigel Godrich, another amazing producer, you can tell there's certain things. You don't. I think it's one of the most interesting things about your output. Is that always, well, I know I can get a good sound like that, doing that with that mic there. Why should I do that again? Let me try and do something different. Is that an intentional thing?
It's very intentional. I mean, I do have a sound. Like, if you listen to, there's my Bowie sound. You know, that's not all Bowie. Hello? There's a guy called Tony Visconti who's also, you know, partnering with him and all that. And I've got a T-Rex sound. And those are as much as my sounds as they are the artists I've worked with.
But they're all very, very different, everything you work on sonically, aren't they?
Well, I worked with a guy called, a wonderful singer from the southwest of the United States, Alejandro Escovedo. And we made basically a glam rock album, and it's my sound. You know, we've made. I mean, I can make these sounds if you want them. I mean, I've got a couple of signature sounds. Okay, but what I really am about is I want you, the listener, to hear the artist, not me. And that's why I align myself with artists who have a very rich texture about them. You know, they write great lyrics. They have an interesting, quirky voice, a voice you can identify. Two words, you know, if you hear Bowie sing two words, that's David Bowie. The people I look for all the time, which is what I did when I came to London, were like iconic people, people who are really different and one of a kind, you know. And then when I go and produce them, I want you to hear that flavor. I want you to hear them. I'll pull out all the stops. I'll invent some new tricks. I'll use some old tricks, whatever works to make their music sound great. And people heavily rely upon me for that and keep coming back for more. Like, I've had relationships with people like Thin Lizzy for 3 or 4 albums, you know.
But I'm dancing in the moonlight. It's got me in its spotlight. It's all right. Dancing in the moonlight.
A lot of people get burnt out, producers and artists get burnt out on one album. They don't want to see each other again. Too much conflict. My relationship with artists is very harmonious. If I'm going to get up every day and fight with somebody, that's not the job I signed up for.
This is it. I was going to ask you about Morrissey, who has, by, you know, reputation, not been the most easy person to work with in the studio, but everything that's talked about your relationship creatively within the studio was all, as you say, it's very harmonious, produced one of his best records.
Nobody knows what human life is, why we come, why we go, so why then do I know? I will see you, I will see you in far.
That's a difficult man to please. But yeah, is it about engendering that relationship and making it a positive thing?
Years ago, we were supposed to work on an album, which I think it was the one that Mick Ronson eventually produced. And we had managerial problems, like our managers weren't communicating well, so I lost that album. It would have been nice. I mean, I always liked the Smiths, and Morrissey's got one of those voices I just described. So I go to Rome to record it. I had to go to Rome like the next day. I had to be on the plane the next day because they had just fired a producer.
There we go. You see, I'm right.
And I heard all these stories. And I have a dear friend who read me Morrissey 101. She gave me an education. Here's all the reasons why you have to work with Morrissey. He needs you. What he needs, great backing. Like, his voice is perfect. His songs are perfect. What's been lacking on his records is the backing. You know, you got to give him something to do, you know, something to sing with, you know.
Frame it properly.
Frame it properly, yeah. So I went out there, and the first day I just went to the studio, listened to a few tracks. Oh, and I met Morrissey that night for the first time in years. And he said, Visconti, I thought you were dead. This is his first words. And now I know how British people are. I laughed my head off when he said that. You know, I thought that was very funny. It was a great way to start the album. And I wasn't offended, you know, and he saw that. And the next day I had lunch with Boz Borah, the guitarist, who also read me a kind of Morrissey 101. So I was getting like two ways, two different things to know about Morrissey. So we worked the next day on a track, one track, with I worked with Boz and Jesse on guitar overdubs. The drum tracks were recorded by the former producer. And I built up a nice patina of guitar sounds and, you know, structured it really well, rearranged everything. You know, I came in, I said, if I'm going to do this right, it's got this bit, you got to listen to me and I know what I'm doing and all that. But I had worked with Boz years earlier when he was with the Polecats. So Boz and I were old. We had something, you know, he always loved T-Rex and all that. And Morrissey came in about 7 in the evening. And I said, well, we've had quite a day. Would you like to listen to it? And he goes, yes, please. You know, he's very reserved. And hit the play button. And I was afraid to look at him. I thought, you know, I wonder if I can get a plane back to New York tonight because I might be, when this song is over, I might be fired. And I looked at him. His eyes were closed. They were fluttering a bit. His arms were folded. His chin was jutting out into the air. It was like, he looked beautifully like Morrissey. And when it was over, he opened his eyes and he looked at me. I said, so what do you think? And he said, beautiful. So that was it. You know, I didn't think I was going to do a bad job. You know, I'm an old hat at this stuff. And I spent the next 7 weeks in Rome doing a great Morrissey album, which I'm very proud of. He never lost his temper once. I was never sacked. We had a little problem with the vegetarianism. And which we solved between ourselves. And I'm a diabetic, and I couldn't eat white pasta and pizza every day, all day. That's all he had out on the take. That's what he lived on, you know, white pasta with cheese. I didn't even think it had tomato sauce on it. So I said, look, I will go into a coma if I eat this food. And I want you to know I don't like to eat meat, but I can't eat this. I have to go somewhere else, get some other kind of food. And he said, okay. He said, don't let me see what you're doing. Don't tell me what you're doing. So we had this nice gentlemanly agreement about what I eat.
I think we should probably end with Bowie, as we have to talk about those last two records, the last two records that he recorded, the last two records that he released the next day, and Black Star, the latter of which won you several Grammy Awards, including Best Engineered Album Non-Classical, for your production work.
I didn't get the Grammy on my own. There was this guy called David Bowie who contributed heavily to that Grammy. And he and I, after 47 years, we were still together as musical partners. And that alone, that's the biggest reward, you know, reward. We both did it our way. We didn't listen to A&R people too much, if not at all. And we got back together on the next day, which I thought, why on earth does he want me back? He could work with anyone. He's worked with Trent Reznor and all that. Why does he want me back? And he did. He just simply did. And we just picked up where we left off on the last album, which was Reality, actually, and Heathen before then. And I didn't realize I'd be making the last four albums of his life. You know, I just thought, okay, he likes me. We get on great. He can try things in front of me. Sometimes David wouldn't be that experimental if he was in the same room with a killer musician, you know, someone who really shreds or, you know, it would be too inhibiting for him. So this is some kind of security, blanket of security I gave him. The next day was great. It surprised everyone with Where Are We Now. That was just superb. I mean,
What a song.
I was giddy from that.
As long as there's rain.
David Bowie comes back with a ballad. And people thought, oh, he's so old and frail. Oh, he can just barely sing and all that. Then he comes out with The Stars Are Out Tonight, and they hear the rest of the album where he's belting like a kid. You know, his voice was really quite strong then. And I'll just fast forward to Black Star when he announced that his health wasn't so good. He gets in the studio and he breaks the decibel meters. He's louder and stronger than ever, full of joy and happiness and optimism.
It's nothing to me. It's nothing to see.
Because he's doing a jazz album, you know, something that it's like a jazz album, it's like a pop album, it's like a rock album, but it's none of those. It's a David Bowie album and something you never thought you'd ever hear him do, you know. And, you know, we did a little experiment with Sue or in A Season of Time with Maria Schneider. And had she been available, Black Star would have been an all jazz album. That's what he wanted to do.
Really?
And Maria said she couldn't do it because she's planning her own album, which usually takes her 2 years to record. And she said, but you want to check out Donnie McCaslin's album, his group. And Donnie was in her orchestra as well. So we did. And in January 2015, we found ourselves in the studio with Donnie playing from demos that David and I created about 6 months earlier. And I said, here I am doing it. I was like really shocked. Here I am doing another David Bowie album, one of many more, I would have hoped, you know. I never really minded if I produced him or not because I'm a Bowie fan myself. Like, I love the stuff that he did with Trent Reznor and other producers. And I even love Modern Love. That's one of my favorite tracks with Nile Rodgers producing that. He also had a lot of anxiety for this album. He said, you know, I may be a bit out of my depth. He goes, these guys are just fantastic musicians. He says, I want you to study their albums. You're the jazz guy. You know, you've got to understand how to communicate with them and how it works, what it is they do. So we had a lot of conversations, you know, prior to this that set it all up. And we worked very much as a team, just surrounding all these new elements that came in, with mainly the Donnie's band. But, you know, there were other things we were trying out as well. And it evolved into probably the best Bowie album ever made. I mean, people would say that was the Ziggy era was the best Bowie album. But I don't know, Black Star is quite an amazing album.
In the filler of all men. In the filler of all men. Stands a solitary candle.
Still, for me, even though I made it, I'm still hearing new stuff in it because lyrically he held his cards close to his chest. I really didn't understand what he was singing about in half the songs. For instance, like the song Black Star was not about him. It could have been about a black person who was a star. But there he was playing his guitar through an amplifier that had Black Star written on it. There's a company that makes guitar amplifiers called Black Star. It was eerie. It was like I was making that record in a Dali painting, you know. It was surreal to make the whole album. Funny things were happening while we were making it, technical things. Sounds would almost make themselves sometimes when we try things out. When you get the crunchy harmonies of Donnie McCaslin's sax and then you put it through effects, it's different than putting that stuff, like than putting an electric guitar through those same guitar effects. You know, the band themselves were aware of this. The keyboard player had vintage keyboards, but all modern effects. And the textures were like textures I'd never dealt with before. It was a new way of cooking, you know. And I spent 9 months with David making this album. And if you want to include the demos, it was well over a year. You know, I'm really proud of it. This wasn't meant to be his last album. He optimistically told me on a phone call in December of 2015 that he had written 5 new songs. Now, I haven't heard these songs. I probably never will, because they probably have no lyrics, which is typical David Bowie, no melodies. But he was raring to go. And, you know, he was cut short. We all know that.
What's the last song that we should play? What should it be?
Well, I think I Can't Give Everything Away by David Bowie. And that's so apropos, because you think you know him and you don't. So I can't give everything away.
Pleasure to speak to you. Thank you very much.
Pleasure to speak to you, Matt.
Upon my shoes, I can't give everything. I can't give everything.
That was I Can't Give Everything Away, the final track on David Bowie's final album, and produced by my guest here on The First Time this week, Tony Visconti. If you missed anything from the show, you can listen again on the BBC Six Music website and the BBC Sounds app, where you can also hear previous First Time shows from Cat Power, Ronnie Wood, Tom Morello, Björk and David Lynch. I've been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.
Six Music.
Yeah.
This morning at 11,
Keris Matthews.
At 8,
Radcliffe and McConey.
BBC Radio 6 Music.
Right now, it's Chris Hawkins.